Today, the Aussie housing supply shortfall. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. It's welcome to this post covering finance and property news, Friday afternoon, and Tarek is with me once again. Hi, Tarek, how are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good yourself, mate.
Yeah, pretty good. There's a lot going on. But it's interesting, isn't it, how a lot of the debate is coalescing around housing.
It is. And to be honest, it's kind of happened quite a bit quicker than I would have thought. You know, like I was thinking, you know, sort of let's call it 12 months ago, that all this stuff would eventually come to the forefront in time. But it's come to the forefront a whole hell of a lot quicker. You know, you've got Jackie Lambie and her little party in the Senate, which is two senators, which is, you know, nothing to scoff at. You know, David Pocock in who's the senator from the ACT, and they're really pushing buttons on wanting to get, you know, some housing reform, some tax reform going around housing investment. And, you know, not only that, but the Greens have jumped on the bandwagon as well. So, you know, there's really quite a big hubbub about it at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say that you know, the government's sort of weaving and diving a little bit, but they're getting enough flat to perhaps make them think differently. We'll see.
They are. There was a really interesting poll out today from Resolve, or at the very least, the results of the poll from Resolve, that showed that Albo is actually falling slightly behind Dutton on who voters trust to manage housing. Now, just before we get into that, it's worth noting that 48% of Australians don't trust either of them on housing, but of the ones that do, who are probably, let's be honest, you know, in large part rusted on voters, only 29% trust Dutton and 23% trust Albo. So that's a pretty poor effort there from the major parties. That just goes to show that people have just lost trust that they're actually going to be able to do anything to fix the housing market.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my latest stress data that I released yesterday shows that there was a further rise in rental stress. So, you know, it's never been higher. Mortgage stress is on a sort of high plateau. It's sort of bubbling along. Of course, more people have already switched, but they're finding it more difficult to maintain those repayments. But others, of course, are paying down their mortgage a lot faster. So if they've got cash flow, they are paying it down. And the other issue, which we'll touch on, I think, is the question of, are investors actually beginning to sell up? Now, there was a very interesting set of articles where people were questioning whether that was true or not. But I think this is a really important question because, you know, if in fact the investor cohort are now sort of voting with their feet too, well, that's going to add an extra bit of spice to the debate, isn't it?
It is. And it's something that's sort of, that I find really, how do I put it? It's something that's quite controversial, something that prompts a lot of discussion. But I think that's relatively interesting when you really think about it, because as things sort of stand today with the number of people renting, it's about almost 50% higher proportionally than it was in the mid-1990s.
Yep.
So when there's this idea, but what shall we do without all the property investors? And it's like, well, we got by with almost a third fewer property investors in the past, and, well, things were just fine. Mm. Housing was more affordable. People rented, people, you know, went through their lives, people bought properties, people just lived. And, you know, there wasn't the gates of hell opening and hell didn't freeze over and nothing exploded. And somehow we managed to just, you know, muddle on through.
Well, that's right. And the interesting observation, the Treasury, of course, recently published information on how much the taxpayer was effectively supporting the property investment sector through negative gearing and capital gains relief, et cetera, et cetera. And there was some other broader research that showed that if you take account of the rental support that's being also offered to some people, you know, a lot of money from government is pouring back into the housing system at a time when there are less people owning outright, more people with bigger mortgages, and way more people renting, and a lot of people desperate to find anywhere at all to live. So, you know, you could argue that the last 20 to 30 years is a complete mess.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, in an article that I wrote on home ownership recently, and I'll get you to put the link in the description, I covered that basically at a state and federal level, we'd spent over 10, over, sorry, over $20 billion on first-time buyer tax concessions and various things to help the rate of home ownership. Now, we haven't done that. You know, things have gotten worse, unsurprisingly. Here we are. But we spent $20 billion, bucks. Now, for $20 billion, you could have built, you know, and this is based on today's prices at a cheap rate, you could have built enough social housing to house 100,000 people. Now, if you throw in the amount of money that we've spent on rent assistance, much of, you know, well, all of which eventually flows to, you know, private landlords, well, generally to private landlords, not entirely, but overwhelmingly, you put all that together, you could have built a whole hell of a lot of homes. And at the end of the day, those homes would have been an asset on the government's balance sheet. And given the settings that, you know, property price must go up, it would have been an asset that would have appreciated in value, not depreciated in value over time. So it's never really made sense to me that we have a government or a series of governments in Australia that wants higher property prices, but then refuses to get in on the higher property price system, whereby they could have just ended up, you know, basically created a perpetual motion machine and, you know, managed to create, well, dare I say, you know, Singapore style amounts of social housing over time.
Well, that's right. And part of it, of course, is the ideological position that, you know, the market has to be the market. And, you know, the neoliberal view of the world is let the market on with it. And, you know, we won't intervene. But of course, as I said, they have absolutely massively intervened. And I guess we should also just reflect slightly on the significant superannuation drawdowns that came through COVID, because a lot of that also went back into the housing system. Not necessarily to, you know, support those who absolutely needed it. So wherever you look, poor policy mistakes are coming home to roost. I reckon we might move straight into the charts, because, of course, the charts are going to be very much around this too. And I have to say, this first one sums it up rather well, doesn't it?
And I think you
could change the label to the the Australian airline equivalent as well, Albo Airline, I suppose. But the point is, of course, that the most recent data from the US on core inflation shocked a bit too. So wherever you look, it's troublesome.
As always, the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com. I would like to just say a quick thank you to everyone who's contributed financially to my work recently. It's been very much appreciated, as has the new paid Substack subscribers. I appreciate your questions as well. Keep them on coming. I will be answering them and sending DMs to those of you who have asked questions. And I will also, if there's enough data there, I might even write some articles on them. Anyway, without further delay, we shall get right into the slides. Now, there's this idea that, and this is something that admittedly a trap that I've fallen into myself at times, that we get this idea that, okay, there are roughly 2.5 people in every house. So if we build roughly the rate of population growth divided by 2.5 and allow for things like knockdown rebuilds, etc., that'll roughly create a sort of equilibrium for the housing market, for the housing to be relatively balanced for you know, sort of, well, I suppose relatively balanced is the best way to put it. But looking back on the number of people, the rate of population growth to dwelling completions, it actually shows that historically we actually need to build a whole lot more properties than that initial calculus would imply. In the 80s, we built 1.86 homes. Sorry, 1.8. There were 1.86 people for each home built. It was 1.37 people for each home built. And in the 2000s, it was 1.92 for each home built. See, there the population is growing at a rate of 3.59. per home built. So basically we need to be building a whole lot more houses or growing the population by a whole lot less if we want to find that equilibrium that we had in, and I would say in particularly in the 80s and the 90s.
Right. And of course in the 80s and the 90s, there was more public housing being built. I mean, there was a very significant surge after the Second World War, and that continued, you know, over quite a long period. And then, of course, was turned down and then pretty much all but turned off. So there's a really interesting, you know, shift in philosophy as we came into the 2000s and beyond as well.
Well, there's a really good chart from, I think it's from Uhuri, and they basically have charted all various social territory, public housing, all the various types of public housing together over time. And they found that at least in the latter half of the, in the sort of latter quarter, shall we say, of the 20th century, it peaked in 1991 at about 7% of housing stock.
Yep.
Now, it's plummeted since then. We're only at, currently at above about 3.3, 3.4%, if memory serves. So it's roughly halved. But that's also meant that there's been that additional space for property investors to expand into. And also for those people who would have previously been in social housing, people who aren't on terribly high incomes, people who are perhaps in need of that type of support, who are now paying a landlord rent assistance, their rent assistance money that they get from the Commonwealth, who would have been sitting in a social housing home otherwise. So that calculus and that balance has shifted dramatically since the early 1990s.
Yeah, and that's an ideological shift, right? I mean, that you know, it was a deliberate policy change, and you know, I would argue that it was a change in the wrong direction.
The thing that gets me is if you actually there's this idea, this sort of meme, this, you know, at times joke, that the people who live in public housing are generally young or younger demographics, people who are dull bludgers, people who, the no-ho, as some people call them. But if you actually look at the data, there is a much greater proportion of people over the age of 55 and over the age of 65 who are living in public housing. Because not everyone who sets out to own a home, you know, if you look back, you know, decades, at best case scenario, it tends to peak in around 80%, maybe a little bit higher, a little bit lower, depending on the generation. So not every person who is older ends up owning a home. And that's a big part of the issue. You know, you've got all these people retiring, all these people reaching their home, and there is increasingly a proportion of people who do own homes that have enormous debts on those homes that are going to be very difficult to service in their retirement. So this idea that it's all just, you know, young people, you know, having a laugh, it's not. In a lot of cases, it's going to support older demographics who just having, you know, got into a property.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I say, I believe it's an ideological shift that happened. You know, as I say, let the markets be the markets, and we don't want to be involved in building housing. I actually think there's a very important role for government, both state and federal, when it comes to housing the population. It should be one of the key objectives of the of government. It seems to me that everybody should have a safe place to live. It should be a human right rather than just a subject of market forces.
But the funny thing to me is that once upon a time, it pretty much was that here in Australia.
I know.
You know, like there used to be debates between, you know, Robert Menzies and the various, you know, Labor leaders who came in the long decades that Menzies was in power, who then, you know, basically came along and said, well, we can build more houses than you can build. We can build more public houses than you can build. And people used to have debates over this. There used to be fights over this in Parliament over who can do a better job to build more homes for the public. Yeah. And you know, that these days is just, I mean, you know, we've got, you know, we can't even get together the money to borrow to build homes these days. No, we've got to start an investment fund and then use the proceeds of that investment fund. It's a long, convoluted process to build public housing homes.
Yeah. This is disgrace, really.
Well, and I think the funny thing is that if we are obsessed with housing price go up forever, aren't we just losing out anyway? Like if we let's just say, for example, that is going to be true until, you know, infinitum, until forevermore. Aren't better off just throwing $100 billion at building homes? And then all of a sudden, you know, 10 years from now, we've paid a fraction of that price we've got money back from the rents, and we've now got properties that are worth 100, you know, with a tad of depreciation that are worth $190 billion.
Absolutely. We should just say, by the way, that Tarek's internet's a bit wobbly today, so we apologise for the occasional glitch, but we're going to battle through, and I hope our listeners will follow through as well.
Now, I put this together based on two separate scenarios. One is the mid-year and economic fiscal outlook, which is basically the mid-year budget update, which forecast migration across the forward estimates. And what I've done here is I've also added the 5-year average for natural population growth on top of that. And then I've also got the numbers from the ABS population pyramid. Now, that's something that before I will get too far into this that I want to ask you about, Martin. Do you happen to know what the ABS forward estimates for population growth and for the various demographic breakdowns, do you happen to know what those are based on?
Short answer is, Tarek, I'm not sure. They're a bit coy as to how they've actually done the forward estimates, it seems to me. I mean, I track obviously the population mix in the census and also in my surveys, and they're quite closely correlated, but I don't know how they project forward. Never really looked at that in detail.
Yeah, I was just curious because I was just playing with it and I'm just like, okay, well they're projecting population growth at over 450,000 for a while there, and that's quite high,
Yes.
and it's sure not coming from the average of about 112,000 that we've seen recently in terms of the natural increase.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna have to ask them and just get a bit of clarification as to why. But yeah, this is roughly the number of dwelling that we're going to have to complete. So Albo's 1 million home target over 5 years, only once you factor in the existing housing deficit, is not going to be enough. It's not going to be enough to house all the people that are going to call Australia home based on even the budget update, let alone the ABS population pyramid forward projections, which
Right, and
is a bit concerning, really.
just to be clear, the MAIFA had higher migration coming down a little bit, but higher migration than we've had, previously. And the ABS is also projecting higher population growth than the MAIFA would actually indicate. So there's something weird about those forward projections. And whichever way you cut the cake, there's not enough property being added to the mix. And as you say, you've taken account of there of vacant properties and other bits and pieces in the calculations. We are way off the target, and even Albo's target would be insufficient to be able to meet the need. This just shows you how big a problem we've actually got.
Well, I think as well is that this is sort of assuming that we have a zero housing deficit at the end of 2024, which isn't going to happen. I think the housing deficit by the end of 2024 is probably going to be the best part of, well, let's call it probably about 150K, maybe more. It really depends on how high the population, how high the migration rate ends up coming in at, because right now we don't know. Because there was an article recently in the AFR that basically concluded that the rate of long-term arrivals into Australia for the second half of the year in 2023 was about 50,000 higher than what it was in 2022. So there's a lot of questions as to how we're supposed to get the number of migrants coming into the country down from over 500,000 down to the 375,000 in the MIEFO for 2022, sorry, for 2023, 2024. So I'm honestly, I don't know. I wish I did.
I'm not sure they know either. That's part of the issue.
Well, that's kind of part of the reason why we're in this mess. I mean, if Treasury got the numbers right in the first place, at the very least, it would have been politically difficult for Albo to sell that. But, I guess it's easier to ask forgiveness than to ask permission.
Yeah, indeed. Good point.
Now, what I've done here is I've shifted it a little bit. And on in the blue, we've once again got the MIEFO projection numbers. And but what I've done is I've compared it to what it would look like if Australia took the peak rate of US immigration in the years prior to COVID and then imposed that on Australia. Now that ends up resulting in a, and what I've done is it's actually a percentage-based figure. It's about 0.45% migration rate as a percent proportion of the existing populace. So obviously over time, that migration rate will slowly grow as the population grows. So what that roughly equates to in 2025 is about 122,000 people. And in 2034, it's about 132,000 people. But as you can see, based on the number of the natural increase staying at roughly the same, it probably won't, but let's just say that it does. we only need to build 120,000 homes a year. But sorry, 123,000 in 2025. So if we could get back up to building, say, 175,000, which is achievable, I think, in on that timeline, you know, as you know, rates bottom and start, then things, you know, do start to improve in the longer term, we could then get rid of that 150,000 home deficit in about 3 years. And I think that's relatively achievable. And I just think it's worth noting that this is what peak US immigration over, you know, in recent times looks like. This isn't the low end. I could have gone a whole lot lower, even excluding the COVID period. And yet the US doesn't have the skills shortages to the degree that we do. Well, to the apparent degree that we do anyway.
Yeah, interesting. Now, a question on your calculations there. You're looking at the migration statistics. Are you looking also at the gross and net population? What I mean by that is we've also got people falling off the perch who own property at the moment, right? And in fact, over the next decade or so, we're going to have more of the baby boomers falling off the perch, which means that there will be effectively people vacating property in a forced way. So is that included in your thinking there, or is it just...
Yes. It's net numbers.
Yeah, good. Yeah. And that's because I get a bit frustrated sometimes when people only talk about the migration without thinking about the total population move, right? Because there are some other changes as well, including, of course, the formulation of households in Australia as well as migrants. But if you sum it up and do what you've done, then it shows that we've got a significant deficit, even with Albo's, you know, challenge. And he's, I know Mims, for example, in New South Wales said, well, we'll try, but there's probably no chance we're going to hit those targets that they were set in any case. So aspirational targets are probably undercooked. Reality of yielding real concrete, literally concrete developments is a lot lower.
Yeah, it is. And I just think that if you actually look at this chart and then look back at the chart that from what we started with, which was property completions per additional persons, this would actually take us roughly back to where we were in the 80s and the 90s.
Mm.
So this isn't exactly like a huge, jarring, enormous thing. And this is still bringing in over 120,000 people a year. This is not, you know, slashing it back to nothing. You know, I mean, that's 120,000 doctors, nurses, you know, tradies, whatever it is that the country actually desperately needs, you know. So, you know, and I think just as an interesting side note, this would still leave Australia with one of the top 10 migration rates in the developed world in per capita terms and higher than almost all of Europe. So, you know, it's all well and good to people say, oh, but Australia's, you know, it's a young nation, it's a small nation. 27 million people live here. The nation is 123 years old. I think, you know, this isn't like post-World War II where we need all these people to come in and build the country. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think that they got it right in terms of the proportion of tradies that they brought in. And we should look at that and go, maybe we should actually bring in more tradies as a, because right now the problem is that we're bringing in a lower proportion of tradies than tradies currently are as a proportion of the existing populace. So we're really doing that whole getting in tradies to build more homes thing. We're doing it real well.
Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of the people who are coming in are students, and they have tried to sort of turn the dial back on the student story. But then, of course, the student story is also stoking the GDP because of the way that the education calculation flows into the GDP. And, of course, universities are squealing, saying, well, we need more, because, you know, our business needs more cannon fodder. So you can see that there are some significant pressures which are pulling in the other direction. I'd also make the point, Tarek, that one of the things that we are seeing, and Edwin and I cover this quite often, is that we are seeing properties being repurposed. So effectively, you know, a house is then sort of reconverted and made into four or five or six, you know, one room facilities. I won't call them residences, because that would be a bit over the top, but, you know, facilities for students particularly. So even the number, if that goes up a bit, it might actually also reflect a particular characteristic in terms of the types of properties and also the types of people being serviced by the properties. So, you know, this is a, this shows you just how big an issue this is. And this is why I started at the top by saying property is you know, a big discussion. And, you know, this is the heart of the matter, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, you'd think that this would be like a pretty sort of basic discussion. You know, I mean, 1,600 Australians are becoming homeless each month. You know, that's a lot of people who are, you know, who are going without. There's millions of Australians who are facing continued acceleration in the cost of their rents, and their wages sure as hell aren't keeping up. You know, for a left-wing government, this should be ringing alarm bells. You know, this shouldn't even be alarm bells. This should be air raid sirens, you know, 10 feet from their bedroom windows. But it's not. You know, somehow we just, you know, pretend that we're going to muddle on through, that we're going to hit these targets that we're not going to hit. And even if we do hit them, it's still not going to be enough to really make a massive dent in this problem. So, I mean, the obvious solution is there, but I don't want to confront the obvious solution because, well, you know, you know what it would do to GDP. I mean, you know, when you're growing the population at 2%, you know, it's pretty impossible to have a recession. When you're growing it at 0.45, like the rest of the world, or more like the rest of the world, it's a lot harder to not have a recession.
So what did you make of the Greens' argument that supply isn't the problem? We've actually got more than enough properties. You know, the vacancy rate's pretty high, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, don't worry about turning migration down. That's not an issue.
I think that there is merit to it in theory. Like in you know, sort of broader terms, that there is this, like, there is this idea that there are buttons that, in as part of a broader strategy that we could push, that would improve the situation. I agree with that. But in terms of, can we continue to bring in 512,000 or 514,000 people per year infinitum and still be able to build enough houses even by pushing every other possible switch they can think of? Yeah, I mean, that's not going to happen, is it? You know, that they can hope all they like, but it's funny. Like, I was saying to someone on Twitter a few weeks ago now, but I just said that basically what happens with politicians is that they understand supply and demand economics just fine, because frankly, anyone who's done year 10 business studies does. You know, it's not a difficult concept. No, it's not. You know, I mean, like, anyone who's ever sold anything on Facebook can tell you what supply and demand economics is, you know, but just somehow when it comes to housing, that part of their brain for politicians just seems to just go off and go on a nice holiday somewhere, and they just completely forget about it. And it's just amazing to just hear these debates from the Greens, from the other major, and from the major parties, just saying, oh, well, we need to do X, Y, and Z. And you're just like, well, what about the elephant in the room? It's literally sitting there taking a giant dump on all these renters. Can you guys you know, maybe do something about that?
Exactly. Just look around. Don't look around the elephant. Recognize the elephant, right? Maybe it's got so big. Maybe it's got so big that they just think it's part of the furniture and therefore they can't think about it.
Oh, it's probably, well, to be fair, I mean, a lot of them benefit from it. So it's probably more like a pet. They're just like, you know, good elephant. Yeah.
Well, of course, yeah, we should say that, you know, the latest data shows that many politicians have significant numbers of properties, you know, 4, 5, 6, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always believed that some of their intention might be a bit diluted by the fact that they've got some vested interests in keeping property prices going the way they're going.
I guess the Pelosi effect.
Love it.
Okay, now this chart from Uhuri is actually, I think it's a really good one. The ABC posted this recently, and what it shows is that the number of households in these different income segments who are renting has shifted dramatically over time. As you'd expect, lower income demographics rent, and you know that sort of tends to rise into the middle, because obviously lower income demographics tend to rent from social housing authorities if they are in that particular position. But the interesting thing is those purple lines. You can see that over time, the number of people in those more affluent excuse me, yeah, because you can see that for 2021, you can see that those people in those more affluent demographics are now renting, and then there's a lot of them renting. You know, people in that in those demos are now renting, and you know, say for example, in the $2,670 per week, section there, that there are over 500,000 of them. Whereas when you adjust that for inflation and you go back to say 1996, which was 25 years earlier, there's only 100,000 of them. Now, obviously, part of that's population growth, so you can account for part of that. But that f more than 5x rise suggests that there's more to it. And the part of the problem is that property prices are not just an issue for people on the lower end of things. They're an issue for a lot of people. They're an issue for people who are more affluent because the properties that they would have bought had things been more normal are now completely out of their reach. And they're now in a lot of places competing for the median. In places like Sydney, for example, according to data from PropTrack, they're now competing with people for properties in the 33rd percentile. So lower value than 67% of properties in Sydney. So this idea that people just, you know, sort of working hard and getting into a property in one of Sydney's more affluent areas, even if they are on telephone number incomes, it doesn't really work anymore. So they're being forced to rent. There's more of them renting, and they're renting for longer. So that's having a ripple effect throughout the entirety of the rental market because there is that more demand there now from more affluent households that didn't exist to this degree in years gone by.
Yeah, and it's worth saying a greater proportion of the population now rent than ever before. So if you know go back a couple of decades, it was a considerably lower proportion. It's continues to rise, and that's partly because people can't get into purchase a property. Sometimes they can't find the property, even if they could afford to buy it, because they can't find the right property on the market because the listings are so low. So they have very little choice. And of course, the other point is that a lot of people, as they go into old age in the rental sector, then find, of course, that their costs of living continue to rise. So they don't have any assets, unlike those with a property of their own. So in fact, in older age, we're seeing much higher levels of financial distress amongst those who have rented through their life because they continue to have to pay more and higher rents into old age. And the only way to solve that is to then get more government support and things like that. So it's a real mess again.
It is, and I just think it's funny that, you know, there's this, I, you know, this idea about, you know, the investor exodus and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, well, look, let's be honest, if it did happen, I'm not going to be, you know, I don't think there's many people out there who aren't investors who are going to be shedding more many tears over it. Because an investor exodus is the only way to raise the rate of home ownership. They're literally polar, mutually exclusive things, you know, and at least what they tell me. Both Albo and Dutton, both of them say, you know, home ownership is the most important thing and blah, 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 blah. I covered this in the article in the description with quotes from both of them. If that was true, then shouldn't we be having settings that encourage the growth in the rate of home ownership and a decrease in the number of investors? Sorry, in the proportion of investor-held housing, because that's the only way it's going to work. I mean, like I said, mutually exclusive goals.
Absolutely. No, it is. And, the way I think about it, it's a bit like a balloon with water inside. You know, you can squeeze it one way and more of it goes over to the investment part, or you can squeeze it the other way and more people get it goes back to the home ownership part. But you can't have a, the balloon is the balloon.
Yeah, exactly right. Speaking of, this is of a analysis by a company called Suburb Trends that basically investigated the proportion of properties currently on the market that were, in their view, formerly investment properties. The proportion for across Australia was 18%. Now, by dollar value, 36.2%, or almost double of the amount of have how of overall new housing finance flows to investors. If we want to look at it from a purely numbers perspective, a little over a third of all new housing finance by number of mortgages flows to investors. So if only 18% of investors are selling, and 33% and over a third of new housing finance commitments are from investors, you can come to a pretty obvious conclusion. If this data is correct, the proportion of housing owned by investors is continuing to rise.
Yep. And the latest housing finance continue to show that in fact quite a few of the lenders have actually been providing differentially, I think, more attractive offers to property investors over the last little recent time because they've been chasing any part of the market they can. So the lending policies of the banks are actually supporting growth in investor finance at the moment. And in some cases, looking at some of the numbers that I've got, they've been able to negotiate better terms than some owner occupiers. So that's another distortion in the market.
Australia. Australia.
It's property.
It is. It really is. Speaking of property, this is of the number of outstanding commercial real estate loans in the US that need to be rolled over the forward estimates. And hey presto, the biggest amount that need to be rolled over in a single year is this year, folks. So it's going to be an interesting one. We saw the US banking regional bank meltdown last year. And who knows? There are signs in some quarters that there could be another one over the continuing issues with US commercial real estate and commercial real estate around the world.
Yeah, and I saw something the other day that showed that the capital value of some of those commercial real estate properties have been dropped by a third to a half. So the underlying value of the asset is a lot lower. So when you think about then refinancing it, the question is, well, what are you refinancing against? The other is that a lot of commercial property over there, and also in Australia, by the way, is not held in a situation where you actually have to mark to market on an ultra regular basis. So the paper value of the commercial property versus what it's really worth, there's a gaping hole. And nobody wants to talk about that. So the question is, when at what point do those mark to market values come into play? Of course, if you refinance, then they would, but there may be other situations where you should be doing it. But private property trust in particular, a lot of black holes there.
Well, did you happen to see that one of the drop in office values across various markets, and it included Sydney that Bloomberg did recently, by any chance?
I did.
Yeah. So Sydney. So for the viewers, Sydney saw some of the lowest levels of property of office price drops in the world that was assessed by Bloomberg. Yet, when you look at vacancy rates and compare Sydney's office vacancy rates with some of the other markets on that list, so markets in Europe, Amsterdam, Paris, etc., you'll find that, wait a minute, our vacancy rates are higher. They're a lot higher. Yet the price of those properties in other nations is dropping significantly more, which does raise the question, as Martin mentioned, to what degree are properties being adequately and appropriately valued in a mark-to-market way?
Yeah, well, I would say that the guidance is a bit weaker in Australia, and we have quite a lot of property, as I said, held in private property trusts and things where they actually don't have the same obligation to mark to market on a daily basis or anything like that. So the other point is that in the Australian context, one of the things that we are now starting to see is some conversion of offices into effectively residential. Now, there's a bunch of issues around that in terms of location and quality of construction and things, but we are seeing quite a lot of that. So I think there's a bigger story on the commercial property angle in Australia than is currently being recognized. And I was quite surprised to see those Bloomberg numbers because certainly some of my other contacts are suggesting that in some cases the true value of those commercial property stories are actually a lot lower than perhaps the official numbers being published at the moment.
I think that there is a bit of a, what's the word I'm looking for? A bit of a clue there. If you look at listed REITs, ASX listed REITs, and you look at some of those that, especially some of the ones that are focused somewhat on offices and that side of the commercial real estate market, because there are parts of the commercial real estate market, in particular the industrial side, the warehousing side, that are still doing pretty well.
Correct.
That's depending on, and that's especially locale dependent as well. There are some places where they're still in very high demand, very nice capitalization rates, very nice rental growth, etc. But on the office side of things tend to be a little bit bleaker. But you look at some of these property trusts and you look at what their then their net asset value is, and then you look at the net asset value per share on some of these listed REITs, and they're worlds apart. You're talking 20, 15, 20, 25, 30, 40% below what the net asset value is considered to be. So I think that does provide some clue that there is quite a bit of skepticism out there in the market over where these valuations perhaps should be. Now, part of that is obviously the issue with interest rates and borrowing costs, but I think that there is that story is still a factor.
No, I think it is. And if you project forward, of course, there's a lot of attempts now to try and bring people back to work in to the city centres, into those more vacant commercial properties. I would argue that one of the reasons why they're trying to do that is to pump up the commercial end of real estate, particularly in the office sector, because, as you say, offices is where a lot of the issues are. I was reading something the other day that suggests we probably had nearly 50% vacant offices in some central business district even now. If you take the full week, obviously the odd day that people are there, but from an occupancy perspective, the story is so different now from where it was pre-COVID. And obviously that has a fallout then in terms of the commercial activity in and around those office blocks. And in my SME services, in my surveys, I see quite a lot of businesses, small businesses in and around the CBDs absolutely struggling. They're not getting the same throughput as they did pre-COVID. So something has, I think, fundamentally changed, and will it bounce back? Well, maybe it will, but could be quite tricky.
Indeed, and I think that'd be an interesting analysis to do at some point, just on how spending patterns have changed. Because people are not getting lunch in the city, they're not getting the coffee, they're not going out for lunch or dinner or whatever anywhere near as much.
Yep.
So the question is that money getting spent then more so in local communities, and is that perhaps part of the reason why we have perhaps seen a level of, what would you call it, a level of resilience in some places that was a bit perhaps unexpected.
Yeah, well, there definitely has been some displacement activity, and I was looking the other day at some data that showed that there's a little bit more spending in and around people's homes. But the other issue is that people's ability to spend is also being crimped, not universally, but a lot of people with mortgages and with rents. So in fact, I was quite interested to see that the latest retail spending numbers, which, by the way, if you overlay population growth and inflation, we're actually recessionary, right? You wouldn't believe that from the public reporting of the results, but that's the case. But in some areas, the spending patterns, were okay. But of course, we did have the tennis in Melbourne, and we had a couple of other big sporting events. And of course, everyone's now hoping that the Taylor effect will, Taylor Swift will actually support the GDP next month. Desperation stakes. I was thinking desperation stakes.
It's pretty unreal. I mean, I've read some estimates. They reckon it could add $320 million to GDP. I mean, why $320 million at a national level doesn't sound like it makes too much of a difference. I mean, given how close run of a thing this could be, maybe it could end up making the difference. And if it does, well, that's just going to be hilarious. I mean, to be honest, I kind of want it to happen just because it would be funny.
It's certainly, well, it's certainly, and they had a similar effect in the US. They were claiming that the Taylor Swift effect actually supported the economy in the US. So maybe we'll see some. And it's interesting, as you say, we're so finely balanced that these sort of little these little things could actually, you know, have quite a significant impact. And by the way, just thinking about some of the other economic data, of course, the CPI data that came out, the observation there was that, you know, if you'd read all the headline news, you would have thought that inflation had been slain, right? But when you actually look at the numbers and look at the re-benchmarking and the baselining that they applied this time around, you can't read anything from the numbers. So I have to say I'm quite disappointed by the quality of the reporting on the CPI data as well.
I went through the data when it came out, and you know, people were saying, well, you know, services inflation's down, and it's like, have you actually read how many data points they actually had for services inflation? Did you actually go through the list? Yep. The number of them, it's like imputed, which means there isn't a new data point
correct
for this month.
Yep.
So no. So I mean, people are like, well, services inflation. It's like, yes, it's because of holiday travel. It's almost all about holiday travel. You take that out of the equation. Well, actually, the ABS did that. The ABS decided that holiday travel was now a volatile item and would exclude it for that reason. And if you look at that, and then you eliminate the issues, and then you factor in the issues with the re-weighting, oh my Lord, inflation didn't move at all. So I just find that a little bit funny, to be completely honest with you. And it's also just that a lot of the current state of inflation in Australia is driven by deflation. Driven by deflation and things like large consumer goods, furniture, stuff like that, and obviously holiday travel. But one, deflation doesn't last forever. And two, well, but some of those big items, they need, you know, quite a large component of their price is shipping costs. And there's this little thing going on in the Red Sea, which I think might have a little bit of an impact on those shipping costs.
Yeah.
So, you know, that deflation may not be as long-lived as some people hope it will be.
Yeah, and don't mention the higher wages growth.
Well, no. I mean, that's another thing too, isn't it? You know, like...
which feeds into services.
Well, exactly. So you've got the two highest levels of wages growth in the economy are healthcare and education. Healthcare and education account for over 10% of the CPI. Yep. And both of them are going to take that hit in the Q1 figures. So it's going to be interesting. You know, if you do see those, you know, private school fees and health costs rise and get baked in for another 12 months, well, that could make things a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
Although, well, who knows what the RBA is going to do with, you know, the issue of rising unemployment.
No, well, that's, of course, the other interesting observation. Well, we'll see whether the RBA still has to worry about the welfare of Australia or not in the debate.
Well, we'll see. Okay. Now, in the last week or so, I've been going through a bunch of Chinese demographic data on how the various sizes of the various age demographics is going to change over time. And what this particular chart is of the aggregate size of the population aged between 25 and 39. So I've used this as a bit of a proxy for people getting out and getting into a home for the first time, as a bit of a proxy for property demand. So what it shows basically is that, in this chart, I've divided it then by the average size of a Chinese household, according to various government sources, which is 2.62 persons. So far, the aggregate drop in demand driven by demographics has actually been relatively minor. But over the coming years, it's going to accelerate significantly, and that is going to eventually have a rather significant impact on Chinese demand for steelmaking commodities, because there just isn't going to be the people to build the houses for in that age group anymore.
Right. And of course, we've also got the hangover issue. We had quite a few new starts that are still being built at the moment. And, you know, the expectations are over the next couple of years that they're going to sort of work through. But the new approvals and therefore the subsequent new starts are already falling off a cliff. Well, if you overlay that chart over the top of it, demand for steel, including from Australia, would be expected to fall. And that we're already seeing it actually possibly in the current steel price.
It's an interesting one, because there's actually a thing out today on from the Chinese government that basically that there are certain locales who have such high debt levels that they are now going to be limited from investing in new infrastructure projects. They said, no, that's enough. You've had enough. You know, it's time to have some water and, you know, walk it off. All right. And that's eventually going to feed through because that infrastructure spending, that increase in infrastructure's share of steel demand and steel consumption that I shared a chart about that last fortnight, that has played a major role in filling the gap left by property. But if that scope begins to run out, whether it's now or whether it's a year from now or 2 years from now, that is eventually going to hit Chinese steel demand and it's going to hit commodity prices, in particular those related to coking coal and iron ore. Now, when exactly that ends up happening is an open question. You know, the Chinese government could continue to find a way to just try and keep the steel mills open and keep them humming along just by throwing more money at it. But as this chart shows, eventually that's going to get to be a bloody costly endeavor. And trying to continue to pay to fill that gap is going to get to be a pretty huge cost. And in time, I don't think they're going to be willing or able to foot that bill.
Absolutely. Well, we shall watch with interest the point of departure between the Chinese stock market and the US stock market. The US stock market being powered along by the Magnificent Six and a bit, whereas the Chinese economy is going the other way. It shows that something is afoot.
I think it's yeah, I think there is that divergence there. But one thing I do think is interesting though is what's going on in the Chinese bond market. That is pricing in sort of low growth, low inflation over the forward estimates. And even if you look at things like say even local government financing vehicle bonds, even some of those are looking, sort of wouldn't call them good because that would just be a horrible thing to say about something so risky, but they are looking impressive, shall we say, considering the enormous risks that are carried with them. But, Chinese households and banks and corporates are just chasing yield and, they're getting into some of this more risky stuff.
Well, and it's interesting that I was listening to a couple of commentators from the US saying, well, maybe the Chinese market is now one that's worth investing in on a high-risk basis because, it could actually return significantly higher quantums than in some other markets. So we'll see whether that happens because the net exit flows of investment funds over the last couple of years have been quite profound. So if that were to turn around, that could also move the markets as well.
No, I mean, something like that can never be ruled out, particularly from a low base.
No.
And, I mean, we're seeing it in, like, as you say, in the Magnificent Seven and, the AI boom and all that. And even in Bitcoin, you're seeing people, number go up, chase number go up.
Oh, yes.
All right. Well, we'll just get to this last slide. Now, the previous slide was of the cumulative impact on property demand on a household level. This is of the population, but on a year on a yearly level. So, sorry, on an annual basis. So basically, for 2023, there will be 4.8 million fewer people in the Chinese age demographic of 25 to 39. Now, I think one of the things that makes this interesting is that by 2025, China is going to be losing roughly an Australia's worth of 20 of people aged 25 to 39 every year. And it will accelerate further to the point where they're nearly losing 2 Australia's worth of people in that demographic by the time that the peak deterioration hits in 2030. So that's a lot of people who are not going to be buying houses simply because they don't exist. So that sort of net aggregate demand to be added into the housing market for the first time, people who are going to buy these new cheap, not cheap, not because housing in China isn't cheap, but cheaper homes is evaporating and is going to continue to evaporate for quite some time. So it's going to be an interesting one because, that there is that effort to prop up demand, but looking at this chart, that's going to get pretty expensive pretty quick once you start seeing those big drawdowns.
Well, especially as, of course, they are backing the idea of the household being a bigger consumer. And we know from all the research around the world that that age group is tends to be a prime sector of consumption, you know, as well as buying houses, they, you know, buy other things too. So if those are actually dropping away, then their ability to stimulate their economy through internal consumption could also be potentially at risk too.
Indeed, but they're going to take the Australia approach, the boomer-powered economy.
Okay.
You know, it's like, you know, you look at spending growth in Australia, it's horrible, yeah. Absolutely horrible in all these, in all the younger demographics, you know, well below inflation. But you look at spending growth for the boomer demographics, for the older demographics, and to be fair, this is in aggregate. So yeah. Obviously it's the affluent powering it and the not so affluent not powering it, but we'll just make that particular distinction. And although it is going to be interesting just to see how it all works out, just because there's the, you know, in China, there's also the one child policy issue. So you've got, you know, the four parents for the, you know, the two kids, and then you've got all the grandparents on top of that. So it's just like this sort of, you know, upside down pyramid of unfun times.
And just reflecting on what you just said, it's worth just highlighting that in the Australian context, right? Boomers in Australia, quite a few of them are spending big. A lot of it is actually international travel. One of the reasons why the CPI weighting was actually weighted to count for more international travel as well as local travel. That has depressed the CPI number on other elements within the CPI matrix. Now, if you are one of those households who are not affluent enough to travel and are spending a greater proportion of your standard income on, you know, things you have to spend on just to get by, your real lived CPI experience is going to be way different from that aggregate weighted average that everybody trumpets about. And it's one of the reasons why I get so frustrated with this, all this fixation on the CPI and what have you, because it's so distorted. And it's being distorted by the proportion of the population with assets, no mortgage, and ability to spend and ability to travel. And that is another distortion that I think is in the numbers and is actually wired in.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I believe that the number previously was a bit under 4% for travel, the weighting for travel. Now it's over 6%.
Correct.
You know, it was, you know, some of the biggest moves in the entire CPI reweighting.
Yep.
And then they also made the CPI reweighting for tobacco and alcohol lower, which also dragged the CPI lower. So yeah, it's interesting. But, you know, for some reason, rents didn't go up that anywhere near as much. They only got increased by 0.2%, which, off the top of my head, is, I think, is actually still lower than it was prior to COVID.
Yeah, and the cost of new builds dropped.
Yeah, and if you were to go out and ask people about what their lived experience was of rents, has it only increased by X amount? They'd go, no, no, it's up by X, Y, and Z. And I mean, although that's the problem with the ABS rental calculation, this is something that Louis Christopher has, you know, talked about at length, that the lag is enormous. Although, I mean, I guess it's going to be interesting in the sense that because of the lag, the level of rental inflation that we're seeing now is the level of rental inflation as it was about 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And the level of rental inflation now is what we're going to see 18 months from now. So that's going to be really complicated and interesting for the RBA going forward, especially if new home prices stay relatively high. Doesn't really leave them a whole lot of room if there's a bit of baked in inflation about and all that deflation that they're counting on doesn't turn up.
Absolutely. Well, we'll see. As always, Tarek, very, very fruitful conversation today. And we got through with a bit of a wobbly internet. So well done. And guess what? When we chat next time, there'll be more stuff to explore because things are moving, you know, interestingly. But I would leave you with this thought, because both you and I believe that the real official CPI numbers are pretty much number wanged and therefore don't take them too seriously.
What are you going to do, mate? What are you going to do?
Well, just watch and comment and just...
Subscribe? Subscribe, perhaps?
Yeah, good idea. Thanks, Tarek. Look forward to the next one. See you in a couple of weeks. Take care.
See you later, mate. Bye.
Bye.